Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, see everybody again. I've put together a little slideshow about what we do in Iraq. It's a little bit hard to display on pictures what it really is. I had left in October, and I came back about 4 weeks ago for a furlough. I'm leaving in exactly 2 weeks again. So this slideshow kind of shows what I was doing in the 9 month I was there. Where the slides start is in the refugee camp in Sedji. That's where Ava is at now. And then I'll go on to show pictures of Sinjar, where I spent the majority of my time, and that is also where Marcus took over for me there. So I'm going to show the slides, and once I'm done with the slides, I'll take a couple questions, either question-answer time a little bit, if you have some questions. So I'll have that at the end. In the refugee camp in the village of Sedji, the government had a program where if you build the skeleton of a house, which is the concrete foundation, you put the block walls up, the concrete floor, they will pay to finish the exterior of the house, the windows, the doors, and also some of the interior of the house. So there's a lot of houses like this went up. And when they put that out about the same time the war started with ISIS, and the government went bankrupt. They have no money. So all these houses are sitting there. None are finished. No windows, no doors, no nothing. But the refugees moved in and lived in these houses because they are a lot better than living in tents. There's around, in the refugee camp of Sedji, there's around 6,000 refugees living there. And they're all living in houses like this. There's a couple hundred houses like this. I don't know the exact number of houses in the village. Now, there's also tent camps set up as for the refugees, the ones that are not in the houses. This Pacific refugee camp has around 80,000 refugees living in tents. There's, I think, 23 different refugee camps like this in northern Iraq. 80,000, yes, in just this one. There's close to 2 million refugees in northern Iraq at this time, give or take some. As they start heading out, a lot are going to Greece. So it's going down a little bit, but 2 million people doesn't go down very fast. Here's just some more pictures of the tent camps. There's also on Mount Sinjar, when ISIS came, they trapped around 55,000 people on the mountain. There's still around 2,000 families living on the mountain in refugee camps there. Wintertime, it gets pretty cold up there. We are about a half an hour drive from the top of the mountain where they were all trapped when ISIS initially attacked. And when I was in the refugee camp there, I helped do a lot of different distributions. I did vegetable distribution, which took a semi-load of vegetables. We weighed it out into bags and distributed to them. We also, I don't have pictures of this, but we did kerosene distribution to a bunch of the refugees. And we also, just before winter hit, took 1x2s, framed out the windows, and put plastic across everything so that they could at least heat their rooms that they lived in. We also put doors on some of them, made wood and plastic doors, so that, they had a way of closing off a room to heat. There wasn't wind coming through the room. In December is when I first went into Sinjar. It got liberated from ISIS in November. I'm not sure the exact date. So about a month after it was liberated is when I first went in to see the city. Pictures from a cell phone tower right behind our house. These pictures are just some of the damage done by airstrikes. What is in the city, what we face when we're there. With this picture here, the front lines would be this brown right out here on the horizon, about a mile out. So from here, you can see the airstrikes and things they are dropping on ISIS and some of the fighting and stuff going on. It's a little hard to see, but there is a large dirt bank running for about 600 miles stretch, and that is where the Kurdish soldiers are stationed. And yeah, basically doing mostly defensive at this point. Every once in a while they have offensive, they push the front lines out farther. Since we have lived there, they haven't moved the front lines there at all. So as you see, there's a lot of damage done in the city. City houses around 88,000, used to house around 88,000 people before ISIS came. To get into Sinjar can be very difficult since you're working on the front line. It took me about 2 weeks of dealing with the government out in the capital and Duhok area before they would give me permission to come through all the checkpoints to get to this city here. They only gave me permission for 2 days to be there. There's two ways of getting permission in Iraq. That is connections with people or the actual paperwork permission. The paperwork permission is very difficult to get. So if you know the high-up officials, it's a lot easier to get around. So we made it into Sinjar. This is at the very end of December. But we got there first. Me and Andy and two interpreters are with us. We met the governor. We spoke with him. He said he wants us there. But I told him we need a house and we also need ways of getting through the checkpoint. So he gave me his phone number. Said, if you get to a checkpoint, call me. I'll tell them who you are. They'll let you through. As far as the house, he said, you can have a free house. We'll find you one wherever you want it. So the first night we were there, we slept at the governor's house. The second night, we slept in this house they gave us. The problem was we were cleaning it the next day. The homeowner showed up, and he was a Muslim, and he was not happy to have Christians living in his house. So we moved on to another house that is where we live now. And here's the situation we came to when we showed up. When they go through houses searching for landmines, they vandalize, or they just go through vandalizing everything. But with some work, you can have a house looking a whole lot more like home. We laid the tile on the floors, everything in that picture. We pretty much, the kitchen cabinets we put in, refrigerator, stove, we bought all that. We pretty much stripped the house out. We had to do new electrical, new plumbing, a lot of different stuff on the house. But it definitely feels like home now that we have it all fixed up. So for work, first of all, it's short-term teams coming in to do a lot of the work. We have short-term teams coming. They used to come for 2 weeks. Since the laws changed, they have been coming in for three, since they get 30-day visas when they get to the country. We've been having them coming in for 3 weeks at a time. And here's a little bit of the work we get involved in. Before the families come back, we get into some of the houses. The homeowners will come in and ask us to work on their houses, to clean them out before they get back with their families. And this is often how the houses look. After they search for all the landmines in the houses, clear the houses, you know, they're rooting through all the cupboards. After that, looters come along, stealing everything they think is valuable. And this is what's usually left of a house when we come. Some of the houses, if you do not want your neighbor to move back in, you go burn his house. That way it's hard for him to fix his house to move back in. There's a lot of hatred there. And since you have several different religions living in the same city and they all hate each other, nobody wants that person to move back. So there's a lot of people burning their neighbors' houses because they don't want their neighbors back, stealing their stuff, whatever, to try and keep them from moving back. There's a lot of hatred going on. Once we get all the broken stuff drug out of the house, make a pile, we burn it. That way the government can come along with their payloaders, clean it up, and, haul it out to wherever. I'm not sure where they dumped all the stuff. A lot of wheelbarrow and shovel work. After that, once the family moves back into the house, we go back in to install doors and glass in the house. One of the refugees from Sedgy, actually two of them, moved in. They live at the house with us. And this is right out in front of our house where they have their own glass business set up. We buy all our glass from them. They sell glass to other people around the city. It is nice. We have translators there with us pretty much all times. And we go out and measure the glass, come back, and they cut the glass for us. Installing glass. Just a couple pictures of how we go about installing the glass. It's just a matter of putting them in place and smoothing it out. Well, first you usually have to chisel the old putty out and break whatever glass is still left there. We also put, if the windows are totally broken, windows like this we stick in, and we also stick doors like this in. There's one of the natives that live in the city there, he has a factory that he makes these. Just got started. So we buy everything from him as far as the plastic doors and windows. Here's his shop where he does all his building. It's about a 5-minute drive from our house. It's kind of the other end of the city. It's a good place to go see every once in a while where something is actually happening and it looks like a home around there and an operating business instead of just destruction. Also, one of the projects we did while we were there is fixing up the school for the people so when they come back, they have a school. Just a couple pictures of what we did on the school, how it looked when we got there. A lot of that stuff we just hauled out and burnt. Books were all tore up. And washed the whole thing out. And repainted a lot of the stuff so that there wasn't so many reminders of what happened there at the school. I also have some pictures of some families we worked for. This is the exciting part of working. When you get to a house, there's parents with children, families. Sometimes there's several families living in a house. Just being able to install glass for them, spend the rest of the or part of the day there just with them, playing with them. It is definitely the most rewarding time. Cleaning out a burnt house or a house where no one's at can get very discouraging because it doesn't seem like you're helping anybody. One of the other things I want like to explain to people, we are the only NGO or non-government organization set up in Sinjar rebuilding at all. As of now, most other organizations say it's too dangerous to be there. So with us being there, I got highly involved with a lot of the government officials there. And they have come to respect us for what we were doing, even though they wish we had a whole lot more money and would rebuild all the houses that were bombed and everything. They see us as a light for helping other people get in. This man here is the head police chief. He is pretty much my go-to man if I have any questions for whatever is going on. Pretty influential man in the government. If there's any problems going on as far as security, when I was arrested, he had been on vacation. He heard about it. He came right in because he knew he could had a lot of sway about what happens to me when with being arrested. Because the foreign people that are there, it is his job for security. So he came in, helped me out, and helped us out. I get over to visit him quite often. This man right here is the governor of the Sinjar region. This is taken in New York City. He came to speak at the UN meetings about the Yazidi genocide. So my dad and some of my friends, a couple of the board members, went up to meet with him, talk to him, and, you know, just see what he had to say about us being there and, yeah, just get a feel for what he thought. And he really liked that. He was, before he left, he talked to me and he said, you know, I want to see your dad while I'm there. So, and he was really happy my dad came up to see him. So he was really bragging me up to my dad. So I think he thinks a lot of me. He was the man I met first when I got to the city. And he's the one that helped us get in and initially set up there. Here's the other military official, the top military official in the region, and he is the man that called for my arrest. So I'm going to tell you that story about what happened in the day, well, what all happened leading up to it and after that. So I got threatened three times. The first time, a short-term team has showed up. We were doing team-building exercises, learning to know the team, and some military officials, they came in and said, listen, the general wants to speak to you. Okay, sounds good. I had never met him before, and I heard a lot about him, and I wanted to meet him. So I was like, yeah, great, let's go. So we went down, spoke, and got there, and his son speaks good English, so his son was interpreting, and he left me know that we got to be out of the city by the end of the day, because he does not want us here. I said, okay. Before I move out, I'm going to go back to speak to the other two big government officials I know and see if they agree with you or not. If they don't, then we're going to have a meeting. Well, he told me not to speak with them, just get out. So when I left, I went to speak with the governor and the police chief. And they, of course, said, no, that military has nothing to do with you. Don't even worry about them. So I didn't. Just stayed. Week later, happened again. And this time he said, listen, you're getting out or I will kill you. So I went down to the governor. I told him. And the governor said, okay, I'll get the president involved. I know the president's brother. I'll talk to him. And it'll come down the chain. That way he never does it again. So did that. Went about 2 weeks later. We were ready to leave for work. And it came up again. And said, well, one of the things the governor told me is don't talk to him again. Just if they come up, come to me first. I'll go with you and we'll settle it. Me and you'll settle it together. So the morning we're ready to leave to put glass in the house. And up come some of his bodyguards and stuff. And they said, hey, general wants to talk to you again. And I told him, no, I won't come along. I got to go speak with the governor before I go speak to him. So they got upset and they listened, you're coming with us. And I said, I am not coming with you. There ain't no way. So there was a heated argument going on. And the person that builds all our doors is a major in the Kurdish army. So he's in control of a good section of the front line. He's a fairly high up major. And he was there. He speaks good English and he was doing a lot of the interpreting. And they did not know who he was. So he finally said, well, let's just go. Let these guys, they're mad, whatever, let's just go. And so we hopped in his truck, and they came up to his door, and they were going to try and not let him go. And he's plays it real cool. He didn't get very excited, but he got really mad that time. He pulled out his ID and let them know that they are speaking to a general in charge of them in a very disrespectful way, and that's not allowed in the military. So they went back to get more orders from the general that was higher up and let him know that one of his people underneath him was not listening. So that gave us enough time. We got down to the governor office. He was not there. His brother was taking his place that day. So I got to the government office. My phone rings. It's Khaled, the guy that cuts glass for us. And he's like, hey, the guys are back, and they are really mad this time. And I said, give them the phone. And I handed my phone to the governor's brother. And I don't know what all got said. There was a lot of hollering going on both ends. And the governor's brother hung up on him and said, listen, I'll go along with you. I said, okay, that's what I want. Come along. That way we have several different government branches represented when all this goes on. And so he did. He came along up. We got to the office, and they got to his office, and he told me, listen, you get out of the city now or I'll put a bullet through your head. And I said, okay. And we left the office and got out of the office. There was about 12 to 14 guys waiting for me. They took me up to the house and told the translator, the glass cutter, said, listen, if anyone ever asks you if you're involved with this organization, tell them you are not, because they're in big trouble and you do not want to be involved. And he said, well, I am involved. Live in their house, know them, we have nothing to hide, and I am involved. So they hauled him in the house too, and they ransacked the house. Took computers, laptops, whatever they thought might be evidence that we were spying for ISIS, because they could not figure out why we would be in the city helping them, volunteers, dumping money into their city, and not be looking for political gain of some sort. It didn't make sense to them. So they thought we were probably spying, and that was a good cover for us. So they took all that, hauled me back down to the military base, where interrogated me for about an hour, went through all my laptop. When they're going through my laptop, on my laptop, I have how to pray for a terrorist. There's a website that, you know, you can adopt a terrorist and you can pray for them. And it tells you how to pray for a terrorist, that he would convert. And when they've seen that, they were like, oh, this is proof that you're really supporting terrorism, even praying for him. And I told him that I can pray for him the same way that it says I should pray for a terrorist, which I think when he was finished reading, he didn't say anything more about it, so I don't think he wanted to be prayed for that way. But so after that, they had me in a room guarded, and me and the translator were together. We were stuck there all day long until evening. When the police chief got in, we went to put me in prison there in Sinjar. They have to go to him first because he's in charge of the prison. So I knew he was good friends with me, so I wasn't too worried I was going to get stuck in jail for the night, because I was pretty sure he wouldn't do it with no proof. So we went to them, had a big argument about, you know, why we have two ways at our house and why we have GPSs and things like that. And it's like the police chief said, every military person has them. If that is enough to convict a person for spying, we can put the whole military in jail. And, oh yeah, they agree. So they have no charges against me. They can leave me go. But they don't like that we have J films and buy a Kurdish Bibles in our house. And the police chief stuck up for us again and said, listen, it's perfectly legal to have for him to have whatever he wants in his house. He can stock all the Qurans, all the Bibles, whatever he wants in his house. He just ain't allowed freely giving them out to anyone standing in the street corner. Because we are restricted a little bit what we give out. But if people ask for them, you can more than freely give out, which happens actually quite often. They want to know more, they ask. So it was about 8:30 that evening, or 8 o'clock that evening, I finally got released. And so I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know anyone else. I knew the team knew I was missing, but I figured no one else really found out too much about it, which I didn't know what was happening on the government end for them. But once I got out, talked to the board, talked to my parents and found out a lot of people knew and a lot of people were praying. And that was very good. So, but we still had a bit of a problem. The general was still not cooperating. The police and the government, they had all went, the police chief and the governor and all them went to meetings with him and let them know that they're sticking out for me and we got to solve this. And he's like, listen, I'm not listening to you. There's no way. I'm still trying to get rid of the guy. So they said, it's your choice if you want to move out or if you want to stay. It's up to you. So we talked about it and we strongly felt that we ought to stay. And we also felt that it was time to stand still and see the glory of God. We had two options at that point. We could have contacted the U.S. Embassy and left them know what happened, and also the news media had contacted us and they wanted to do a story on it. But we decided not to contact the embassy. They didn't know anything about it. And the news media, we told, no, we don't want to spread this story out yet. Because if we want to be friends with them, it's best off nobody else knows it. So it took 4 weeks, stressful weeks, of not sure what's going to happen. And I was down in the military headquarters one day, and I was telling some of the soldiers that had ransacked our house that I became friends with after that, that I want to speak to this general again. And they were telling me, no, you don't want to talk to him. He's no good. And I said, I want to talk to him anyway. So they finally left me in and said, you can talk to him. So went in his office, not sure what I was asking for. And he told me, listen, forget everything that happened. I want to be friends with you. I said, okay, I mean, that's fine with me. I'm willing to be friends. I don't know what happened, but 2 days later, we're down there having lunch at the headquarters, and he came over with some of the other generals to meet our entire group that was there at the time, just to say hi and introduce himself. And a couple days after that, we were at his house, and we had supper with him, which was a very great time. Still look at him. Every time I see a picture of him, I can remember him glaring across his desk, really mad. But God has changed something, and I'm not sure what. And I just glorify God for that. Janelle was also there she was on the team that was hunting for me, trying to figure out where they took me. So she'll tell her side of the story of what happened that day.
Okay, so we were getting ready to go out and work. We were loading up the glass, and all these guys came up to tell Chad that he has to come. And we were like, well, you know, from what has happened before, you know, we're pretty sure that the governor will take care of this and it won't be a problem at all. So we were like, yeah, we might as well go out and start working once, and he'll just come when he's ready. So we did, and all morning, I had a burden to pray for him, so I was praying for him all morning, and we didn't hear anything. And then about noon, one of the guys that was there needed to go back to the house to get another piece of glass that was missing. So he went back, and when he got there, the gate, there's a guard guarding the gate and wouldn't let us in, or wouldn't let him in. And he was like, hey, like, this is weird. Something is wrong. So he came back, and he's like, Janelle, what should we do? And, well, we were just about ready to eat lunch, so you know, it's rude to leave just before you would eat. So I was like, well, let's stay here and we'll eat lunch and see what, we'll do something about it after that. And in the meantime, we were trying to call Chad and trying to call the translator and could not get a hold of them. We tried and tried and tried and tried. And finally, we got through the translator and he said, I can't tell you where we're at. I can't tell you who we're with, but we are alive. And there's people in the background yelling at him to get off the phone. So that's all we knew. So we finished lunch and went back to the house. And the guard was gone when we got back. So we went in, and the house was locked. So one of the guys went up through onto the roof and got in that way. And the house was ransacked, and our dog was missing, and it was strange. We knew something was wrong, and we had no idea where Chad was at. Well, we figured he was with Casa Special somewhere, but we didn't know where. And so we sat right away, and we had a prayer meeting, and we had no one's phone number, so we didn't even know. We had no one to call. So we went and went to our friend, the major, to see if he could help us out. And he was like, yes, he'll help us out. He'll help us find Chad. So he said that he might be in De Hook, which is 4 hours away, or he might still be there because they're talking about transporting him. So he said, you know, he really doesn't know where he's at. And then we said, okay, well, is he all right? And he said, well, he doesn't know if he's okay or not. And we were, and he was like, you know, it's going to be okay. This happened. This stuff happens all the time. But you really should call the American Embassy and, you know, let them know, get some help. And he's like, but, you know, it's really just fine. No problem. And so we were like, okay, that's really not lining up. You know, it's no problem, but we're still supposed to call the American Embassy. Anyway, so we started going from Army base to Army base, trying to find him, see if anyone would help us, because connections is a big thing over there. You know, if you have the right connections, you can get what you want. So we searched for him for hours and hours, and no one would tell us where he was, or if he was okay. We're like, look, if you tell us if he's okay, we'll stop bugging you so much. And no one would even tell us that. So finally, we were waiting for a long time. Well, they told us to come back at a certain time, and they'll have some answers for us. So we came back, and we're sitting there waiting. After a while, they came back and said that he's released and we can go home. And, well, actually, before all this, as soon as we went out to search for him, I called back to the States and let people know that we need prayer. And I know a lot of people started praying after that. A lot of people found out. So I think prayer had a big thing in getting him released and all of that. So yeah, it was a long day, but we got to see God work in big ways.
These two men here were the men in charge of the whole investigation. They were both wounded in a suicide bombing 3 days after I was arrested. Here's a video we put together of some of just a timeline of stuff happened in Sinjar and a little bit of what we're doing. The video there said 20 to 30 families moved back. It's closer to 50 or 60. When I left a month ago, I'm not sure I've come back since then. So yeah, I just want to thank you for all the support and the prayers, everything you've given us. And yeah, if there's any questions, raise your hand. I'll try my best to answer them. Okay, as far as the attitude of the people, they really like us there on a government level and also as far as locals around. Sometimes people say we don't get there fast enough to install their glass, but other than that, they are very glad to have us there. And as far as the news media, it was a worldwide news media site that wanted, or at least in Asia-wide. Not sure how wide they cover, but, you know, they have their television shows in Iraq and also a bunch of other countries. So it would have soon got worldwide, I think. Thank you. as of now, right now, we are pretty much helping all the families that are coming back into the city. We do glass and doors only. Other than that, they pretty much have to fix up the rest of their house on their own. Once you have glass and doors in the house, a family can live in the house. Even though there's a bunch of stuff broken, electric might not work, they can still lock the doors. If it gets cold, they have a heater in the room, they can heat the room. It makes the house livable. As of now, we're pretty much helping any families. It's very hard to determine financially what people need. You know, some of the government officials there, you know, when their families come in, we help them out. And so they might have been very rich before ISIS came, but when ISIS came, they pretty much lost everything they had. So did they gain stuff back while they were refugees? Are they still very poor? It's very hard to tell. So we will help anyone that comes back. But we limited to what makes the house livable.
The videos showed people, maybe it wasn't your group, but they were cleaning. They were picking up the trouble in the house. Is that you or another team?
Yes, that is us. We do come in and we will sweep out the houses before the family gets there. That way it's clean. Before, far as putting money into the house, it is pretty much doing buying glass and doors for them.
The local families that are actually coming back in, do they also come in and help clean up the house before they actually come in?
The majority of the people that have moved back have actually come in and cleaned out their own houses and stuff. It really depends on the house. Some of the houses, a big thing, if ISIS lived in the house and has a bunch of their stuff there, they don't want to touch it. They want everything out and burned, no matter how good, no matter how bad it is. They don't want memories left. But if ISIS was not in the house and it's their stuff there, some of the families will come back and do their own. It kind of depends. Before ISIS came, there was three major religions in the city. You had your Yazidi, you had your Sunni Muslim, and your Shia Muslim. Sunni Muslims, most of them would have joined ISIS when ISIS came. Shia Muslim is, I'm not sure the exact difference. And then the Yazidis are, so we work a lot with Sunni Muslims and Yazidis is what we work. The Sunni Muslims are hated that bad, which most of them left with ISIS. They didn't stay. They joined ISIS, and as ISIS retreated, they do too. But between them three, they all hate each other. Even though the Sunni Muslim, the Shia Muslim, we would know them both as Muslim, they do not get along. Kurdish. The refugee camps are pretty much controlled, it seems. There's a lot of people that do set up outside the camps, because the camps are barbed wired, fenced off. So there's some people that do not want that. They set up outside, but they do not get a lot of the food distributions and stuff that happen inside the camps then. So there's disadvantages to living outside, but there is some that do.
So there's not a lot of looters.
Yeah, they're pretty much, it's all camps.
How far away are these refugee camps from the camps in Europe? Are they some distance away or is it very close?
Majority of them probably are 3-hour drive away. They're still owned by the people that are in the village there. But a lot of them do not have money. A lot of them houses, like, the people heard about this deal the government was making. They put up 7 or 8 houses. They had money to put that many skeletons up, and that's what they did, because the government was going to pay for the rest. Then they were going to sell the house. And so now a lot of them, there's a couple of the houses that they kicked the refugees out, and they're finishing out because they want to sell, but very few. One of the biggest things that are holding back now is retaking Mosul, because Mosul's kind of out on a finger. And so the front lines, when they go in to take over Mosul, the front lines close to us are going to move out, move away, and that will make it safe for people to move back in. Because as of now, there's still some rockets and stuff that reach the city, that land in the city there. So it is not perfectly safe for a lot of families to bring people to bring a lot of their families in. There is still quite a few, but yeah. Yeah, Sinjar is maybe a little bigger than some of them, but the Sinjar region or county, there's 105 smaller villages that look about the same way. Anybody working in those? Not rebuilding yet, no. Some of them are still under the control of ISIS, though, so you can't work in all of them yet. But yeah, there's very few people in rebuilding at all yet. Yes. Yeah. A lot of NGOs say it's not safe because there's still rocket fire, and if ISIS breaks the front line, Sinjar's the first town they'll come to. So there's very little warning if they do break the front line. So most people say, well, it's dangerous to even live there. So, well, if you go in first, you get the government connections you need to go farther for the next time. If we wouldn't be there first, I would not have the connections and the good standing with the government that I have now.
Approximately how far is the city to Lutajic? Because wasn't there fighting between ISIS about 6 weeks ago?
That's southern Iraq. That's down close to Baghdad. We're in northern at the very top. That's at the southern end. About 2,000 families, yeah. About 1 mile. Yeah, pretty fast. We do evacuation drills every once in a while and stuff. They're often doing the attacks. Almost every day they're just doing small attacks on the front line. But their power, the military is pretty well grounded. They have their front lines heavily trenched. Like, they can't get tanks or vehicles or anything across the trenches and big dirt piles and all sandbagged in. So it's going to be very hard for them to break through. They're going to have a lot of firepower, especially since the U.S. is flying all the air cover. They can't just come cruising out with a big convoy. because the U.S. will take them out. There's not much of an escape plan to happen, but yes, we do evacuation drills for every team when they come. Well, one of the reasons for moving into an area like that and starting to rebuild, I feel a lot of NGOs, non-government organizations, they want to come and get the glory coming in behind the people and, you know, they're help some people here. I like getting there before the people and getting rid of some of the reminders and getting the house ready for them so when they come back, they have something to actually move into. If you came back to your house, everything was ransacked, windows broke, doors kicked down, everything just scattered everywhere and broke, you would be happy to have someone come in and clean up your house and put windows and doors in that when you come back with your family, your children, it was something you could come to that felt like home. And that, even though it's very hard to go to a house where no one's at, clean it up, and get ready for someone that ain't even there and you don't even know, in the long run, it definitely pays off. Well, I think at this time, I'll turn it back over to whoever is going to close.